So
I never eat, even when I'm hungry. That was the stupidest line I've ever
heard. The dialogue was a little silly. But comparing it to Matthew McConaughey and...
I never saw that one.
Then how? Don't judge!
Hold it, everyone. I need to announce to some of you who may not know this yet that Wonkcast is producing three episodes a week. On Mondays, we produce our standalone Below the Fold series. On Wednesdays, we do a deep dive into a policy with a guest. And on Saturdays, we post our live recording with WRGW, George Washington University's radio station. If you want to hear us live, listen in on Fridays from 6:30 to 7 p.m. at WRGW's website or on iHeartRadio. Thank you. Enjoy the episode.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Wonkcast, the independent student podcast of the GWU Trattenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. I'm Eric Ledoux. I'll be hosting this episode along with my co-hosts, Gabe.
Yes, me.
And Kat.
Also me.
Wonderful. And everyone, lucky listener, you have tuned in for once again our Monday series special, Below the Fold. In this series, we look at issues that didn't show up in the media, or maybe had just a mild mention. Co-hosts, Kat, Gabe, what stories do you have for us?
So, my story for Below the Fold is an investigation that Politico did recently, and they published it about 3 days ago. It's regarding the minimum wage fight and how there is little to basically no enforcement of minimum wage violations. So, according to Politico's investigation, which any of our listeners, Wonkcast, or policy students at Trachtenberg, I think it's really worth reading. Investigation came up with 6 states all in the South that have no public servants dedicated to investigating minimum wage violations. So if there is someone that's being paid under the minimum wage, they actually have to file complaints or process paperwork with the Department of Labor, who selectively pick which cases that they will investigate. 26 states have fewer than 10 investigators that look into minimum wage violations. And again, a lot of these people will have to take their complaints to the Department of Labor. This also includes employers that are not paying their employees at all. It's not just, hey, the minimum wage in our state is $11 and I'm still paying you $7.25. It's, I haven't paid you for 3 weeks and your family is starving. Political is also bringing up the point that a lot of Democrats have been pushing for minimum wage increases in the past decade, and it's been long overdue, but at the same time, you have a lot of states where minimum wage has gone up and, you know, municipalities and cities where the minimum wage isn't being enforced. This is happening particularly in places where a lot of undocumented immigrants might be working. So that's restaurants, landscaping, nail salons, or any place that might be likely to hire illegal labor, because these people have no protections and they don't feel comfortable or even safe going to any authority figure saying, I'm being paid, you know, $2 an hour to clean toilets at a, you know, high school or whatever it is. So it was a very interesting investigation and kind of goes into our public and a private failure. Private failure in terms of, like, we're allowing the private markets to manage themselves and comply with minimum wage, and then public failure in that there's no enforcement of the laws that we're trying to push, no matter how progressive that they are.
I think about a state like Washington that's really been primary in this fight with the minimum wage in the SeaTac area, and thinking about the large swath of rural land west of the Cascades and then all of eastern Washington, there are a lot of undocumented folks living in those areas working rural jobs, largely in agriculture. Most of them work for companies like Driscoll and are routinely abused, not just in terms of wages, but also run-of-the-mill labor abuses, you know, threats to their lives, no sun safety, very low hours of rest, just horrible violations. And I, you know, it's kind of, it's sobering and saddening to see that happening at the same time that the policymakers are living in the city that will see the labor laws enforced, because it's easier to enforce them in a city. They'll see the benefit. And the people who are actually hurt the most by the labor system are unable to articulate it and not proximate enough to be seen.
The article also goes into a lot of nonprofit or labor organizations that are coming across people in these industries, like janitorial staffs or landscaping, like I mentioned earlier, that were told, no, this is what they say that they're supposed to pay me. They honestly just had no idea that they've been either tricked or manipulated or were just unaware of their rights as employees to be paid this amount, and so it's equivalent to wage theft. Just like if I'm on the clock and I'm dilly-dallying and then my employer wants to call it wage theft, them not paying me the proper wage is wage theft on their part.
Mm. I mean, it just sounds like this is an enforcement, but maybe it's also like a public notice campaign that needs to happen. Maybe what should happen is government should actually have, you know, rent out some billboards and say it's your right to this much per hour at least.
The thing is, the people hurt by it the most have no recourse. They don't have a recourse to the law because the law is ICE, right? If the law is immigration, then you don't have a way to say I'm being horribly abused.
In those instances, as well as like U.S. citizens, like legal, whether that's green card status or, you know, born in the United States, these are people that aren't being paid wages. And as far as being able to go on a campaign of know your rights, that being said, there are still six states that have no one you can go to except for the Department of Labor. You have to take this to a federal level. And then there are also rules in states where they're not willing to even hear your case. Like, you know, if you're low income, $200 goes a really, really long way, and it takes up a significant amount of your income that you bring home every month. A lot of places or investigators won't even take up cases that are below like $5,000 of wage theft by an employer.
Has there been suggestions on how to solve this problem?
In the article, I haven't seen anything that creates a suggestion, just kind of giving you the landscape of where things exist in the different workforces across the country and in specific states. As policy students, you know, we want to be able to work with private entities and the public sector to fix these problems. But at the moment, it seems that the government just doesn't have the resources to even try to make these employers accountable and increase their wages of their employees or even suffer any penalties. So it seems like maybe government would be the solution, but right now there's no infrastructure for a lot of states to solve these problems.
I wonder if any state has some kind of process for recouping what would be stolen wages or fining people, even if someone has like hired someone who is an undocumented laborer and they don't pay them well, you know, even if you come in and you stop that operation, you can still fine that person for, I guess what I would say is like undervaluing human labor.
I think the fallacy there is that the government would want to do that. I think that the situation is that these companies contribute massively to the state incomes, right? If you're looking at Driscoll's, for instance, in Washington State, massive amounts of returns for the communities that it's in that it is a large economic powerhouse, and coming in and enforcing these minimum wage laws has been an incredibly hard fight for the laborers and for activists in the community. And it has taken a long time, and it still is a long way from being adequate in a very progressive, highly regulated state. So I think in general, if the idea is that the government has an interest in protecting these people, I think that might be a hypothesis that needs to be examined, because I just don't think it plays out.
I will say that Politico's survey of 15 states that had comparable data found that 41% of the money that was, quote, stolen by employers was never recovered by the employees. So even when people have gone and filed complaints to get their wages back, this is pay for an entire day, being paid the minimum wage, or being paid overtime, they only get about 60% of what they're owed back.
So on that happy note, we always end on happy notes around things, huh?
I'm really
Gabe,
good
you have
this.
A sto- do you have a story from?
Yeah,
I love.
I've got like a theory in practice this week. So in our classes, we're given this theory of the primordial soup of public policy. And it's this really antiquated, kind of unrealistic view of how policy is made that supposes that there's just a slosh of ideas about how to solve various policies, and policymakers and activists kind of wait for the right opportune moment to propose their policy solution, right? If you think that guns, for instance, should be more heavily regulated, you look for opportunities to push that sort of regulation. The reason why I'm saying guns is I'm thinking about this recent shooting in Florida, which is just horrible, and the activism that has kind of sprung out of this tragedy. It's inspiring. It's truly awesome to see so many people galvanized so powerfully to a single message. I think it's really awesome. I'm excited to see where it goes. However, these policy windows do often capitalize on completely absorbing the national conversation. And so what 2 weeks ago I might have thought would have been breaking news at this point is not talked about. And specifically, I'm thinking about DACA. I'm thinking about the fact that on March 6th, renewal is up. I have no idea what's going to happen in the Senate and in the House, but I'm looking at the national discourse. I'm looking at the headlines. I'm looking at what is being talked about. And the focus is not on a program that is about to expire and 800,000 people that are about to lose their protection, right? What I'm seeing is a lot of interest and a lot of excitement and a lot of discourse and a lot of Russian hacking over the issue of gun control, which is totally worth talking about. It's legitimate. I'm not trying to say that this isn't a pressing issue. It absolutely is. But the problem is, it's a pressing issue without a deadline, taking the stage over a pressing issue with a deadline. And I mean, this is just kind of an unfortunate side to the policy window that we don't talk about, right? We like to think in positive terms, right? We can really capitalize to push an issue that we're passionate about and really make change. And I think these people will make change. I think there will be something that comes out of this. I'm excited for it. The consequence is that we lose focus on other things and other issues. We have a very low spectrum.
I personally believe that DACA recipients will be able to stay, but I don't think it's going to be on.
My point in talking about this is to highlight the fact that the way we approach politics is inherently problematic because we just flock to the hot topic. And I don't think that there's any inherent thing that we can do to change that. I am just disappointed that there has been so little focus in the last week on an issue that is very present. And I'm not saying that there aren't many people activating for it constantly. I'm just saying that from the senators, from the representatives, this issue has cooled. And it has cooled, I think, because they can let it cool, because it's much easier, much, much easier to debate gun control, knowing that it probably won't change for a long time, than it is to try to really discuss what is going to happen to 800,000 people and their families.
I think we touched on this last week, too, with our Puerto Rico episode. Trying to do research for that episode, I couldn't find articles dated within 2 weeks of relief packages or aid going to Puerto Rico, because it's not in the news anymore. No one's talking about it because of DACA, gun control, everything. Mm-hmm. The window was there, but now it's, hey, there's still a lot of people that don't have electricity, and oh, that giant budget problem that they have.
Yeah.
But it's not in the window.
Yeah, the fact that we're not talking about how FEMA grossly underserved the food requirements of the island.
Misappropriated those funds of just the meals.
This is all kind of what I was getting at, just the idea of single issue politics goes far beyond voting, right? It is the way we approach our political system, and unfortunately it's the way our lawmakers approach our perception of the political system, right? They capitalize on a single issue at a time. They might all individually be working on many things, and they work very hard, but the way they approach the public and their Twitter feeds, their public announcements, it is single issue and it is the salient issue. And that, to me, is very, very alarming when there are real, incredibly timely issues that are about to completely explode.
The political observation is, what's the hot topic right now? I want something done about it right now. That's not how our government is designed, is it, to get things done immediately, and
not
especially under current gridlock. And so it feels like we're stuttering a little bit here, or it's like a record when it starts to scratch. Like, we get caught up on one thing, and it's kind of ruining the entire run.
I will say there is potential. I mean, in talking about gun control, the Brady Bill represents one of the most comprehensive pieces of gun legislation we've passed.
What is the Brady Bill?
It's the gun regulation passed right after Ronald Reagan was almost assassinated. Right, it was pushed through in large part by the testimony and the advocacy of the man that was shot and hospitalized right next to Reagan. Right, so this was a huge media event. There was coverage of it constantly. It ruined just our whole conception of presidential safety. I mean, it had been a little while since JFK. It was fresh, right? That this could happen in the 80s. So when you have that, you have this huge swell of momentum, and you have gun legislation passed by a conservative Congress, by a conservative president. Now, I think that could happen again here. And I think what's cool about the way this is being handled is, as everyone's saying, it's being pushed forward by young people, people who normally wouldn't register to vote, people who normally wouldn't get civically engaged. Now, this is really cool considering that this is an election year. This is a year where we really need a lot of civic engagement. We really need a lot of people who actually care about issues. And so if this might just push people into political engagement in a way that traditionally 17 to 19 year olds are not galvanized to vote.
I think it's amazing that they are getting so motivated to express themselves. And I think it's even more powerful when it's coming to potential victims. And the things that make us all extremely sad are mass shootings in general, but it's particularly ones where you leave your kid at this building for 8 hours a day to get their education and you expect them to come home at the end of the day. And that the future victims, like, just wait, if they don't pass gun reform and then they have a picture of a girl who is holding her gun control poster and she's one of the students that's killed in the next mass school shooting, how is that going to look?
I will say that I would ask, at least with this gun reform, if we're talking to our potential galvanized listeners, remember gun violence exists on a systematic scale that goes beyond mass shooting incidents. I think that we have, like I was saying, this tendency to unify an issue to a single salient point. And while it is very important to talk about gun violence in schools, the mass majority of gun violence is not in a school. It is in people's neighborhoods, in people's homes, committed by people in positions of authority. If we're going to think about this in a holistic way, if we're going to try to not think in just these really salient flashpoint terms, when you're getting ready to vote, when you're getting ready to be engaged, think globally about that engagement and how the larger picture of what you're getting engaged about might look like.
I think that's, for one thing, that I think policy students, we tend to lose focus on, especially like as WonkCast people, we get to talk about different subjects, different policy topics on a weekly, sometimes daily basis in a lot of our classes. And then we forget that most Americans don't pay attention to everything like we do. Mm-hmm. Like my dad, he's an issue-based voter, and there are plenty of issue-based voters out there who, it's not that they don't have the capacity or the intelligence or even the patience to do some of this, but like
it's just how they approach issues.
Or it's just like, that's like, I go to work, I have my family, I have, you know, This Is Us and my HBO Go. And like, there are some people that just really don't care.
We're in this circumstance where we don't feel galvanized until it's one issue, and that one issue is very narrow. We'll be tied to one thing specifically.
And it's very quick.
Easily digestible.
Yeah. Easily digestible.
Guns kill children. That's perfect.
So we need guns to stop killing children.
What? No.
No. We need...
No, we need legislation to stop guns from killing
children. Realized how that sentence could be seen two different ways.
Even that, right? I mean, that whole gun, you know, people with guns kill children in schools, so we need to stop people from getting guns. But that in itself is not a holistic policy stance, right? It isn't something, it's a part of the puzzle, but because we're so focused in on that issue, we're missing what might drive that person to commit such an atrocious act. Right. Mm-hmm. What might cause that whole situation to occur? What might cause it to be so easy for someone to purchase a gun? What economic situations might lead someone to want to purchase a gun? Why might all or the majority of those shooters be white men? Right. Like there's this whole range of policy implications around it. But we're so focused in that we lose sight of anything that could resemble holistic policy. I think the consequence is very narrow, very targeted, very globally inefficient and ineffectual policy.
I think if you're speaking about lip politics and policy class, there'll be a point where you talk about policy monopolies and policy images and policy venues. And the one part I think that you would find most interesting is when we discuss policy images, where it's basically the party or the institution and how they frame and basically snapshot an issue for voters, for politicians, for special interest groups, and how successful you can be in creating the framework is how successful you can be in pitching, selling, and implementing your policy. Because if you bring it down to one of these digestible moments, say snapshot immigration, some people think MS-13, some people think DACA, you know, 19-year-old person trying to get their education. It's just the matter of how do Democrats and Republicans, how do you create the framework and create the messaging that drives your policy?
The media has, it's part of their interest to make it so that I can say this one sentence and it's as if it has a political double entendre. Democrats will take it one way, Republicans will take it the other, but they'll all be engaged in how I'm reporting this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This topic is not intended to deride people for activating on behalf of victims, for voicing their concerns with the system at large, with trying to legislate or activate for stricter gun control. I think all that is wonderful. I'm more pointing to a critique of the way we as people engage with policy in general, not specifically this group of people, which I think are doing exceptional work.
But I agree. I think there are a lot of people that just don't come from our wonky background that I think if they took time. I know I've definitely had plenty of Thanksgiving and Christmas fights with my father.
Kat, Gabe, thank you so much for bringing us some stories from Below the Fold.
No, thank you, Eric.
Thanks for coming to GW Wonkcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. For more wonkiness, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is @GWWonkcast. Send us love letters and hate mail. Email us at wonkcast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and iTunes. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher. Our editors are Eric Ledoux and Eli Richmond, with music by Pele Gunther.